Hello, enormous podcasting world. Welcome back to Big Mouth, where every week we rifle through the racks of pop culture looking for something to distract us from the horrors of the outside world. I'm Andrew Harrison, and joining me as usual is Sean Pattenden, the dependable and conscientious owner of our metaphorical Exuma Point Bar and Grill, to my incompetent and untrustworthy Billy McFarland. How are you doing, Sean? You're
right. I'm all right, thank you.
The Fire Festival thing continues to roll on. Marianne, who the cafe owner woman, she opened a GoFundMe to raise the $50,000 she lost, and it's now raised $200,000.
Which is wonderful.
Which is wonderful. That's nearly enough for two tickets to the next Fire Festival VIP by helicopter.
Yes. There will be another one, definitely.
Somebody will surely buy the IP. I think there's a business model for Big Mouth there. We stage a disastrous rock festival with supermodels, perhaps on Hilbury Island on the River Dee. We lose a fortune and then we clean up on the GoFundMe.
That's perfect.
Let's do it now. Absolutely. Yeah. We have two special guests with us today. This year, Dylan Jones celebrates 20 years as editor of men's fashion dreadnought GQ magazine. Before that, he was editor of ID and Arena magazines and a senior editor at The Observer and The Sunday Times. He's the author of countless books, including most recently the double dame whammy of When Ziggy Played Guitar, which looks at Bowie's performance of Starman on Top of the Pops in 1972 and how it changed everything, and also the self-explanatory David Bowie, A Life. Despite being the menswear chairman of the British Fashion Council, he is both an old punk and an old new romantic at heart. Mm-hmm. Hello, Dylan. How are you doing?
Very good. Very nice to be here.
Thanks for coming on Big Mouth. Is the Fire Festival making an impact up at GQ?
It's one of the three topics of conversation at the moment, yes. The other two being Brexit.
Both being Brexit. I mean, you live in a world of supermodels and influencers. Is there a sense that maybe the world that kind of social media and fame has built is now turning around to eat itself, perhaps?
I think it's been eating itself for quite some time.
Yeah.
But obviously this documentary, this topic of conversation it's just got hubris written all over it. It's fantastic. And also it keeps on giving as well, because there seems to be almost hourly updates. So it's a very good topic of conversation.
Have you seen the Hulu one as well, the kind of companion documentary?
Someone was talking about that just this morning, actually, but I haven't seen it myself.
It's really good because it's quite businessy. It runs the numbers.
Yeah.
And you see that as well as being a bunch of absolute chances, they're also a bunch of absolute crooks. Which is, doubly entertaining. Is influencer fame real fame? Does it leave any footprints? Is it here and gone?
I think the way that it's changed is that the target audiences are beginning to quickly realise that it's all transactional. Mm. And I think that obviously some people still have huge appeal. People generate enormous followings. And they become sort of micro celebrities in their own micro worlds. But I think that in terms of a greater influence on the industry, that ship has sailed. Mm. Because a couple of years ago, you were finding that a lot of fashion editors had their noses put out of joint because their chair was taken away. Their chair was taken away and given to some spotty, overdressed 15-year-old. But this is sort of stopped now, because I think that a lot of those influencers, their followers are 12 to 15-year-old girls, mm-hmm. who economically are not that important to the fashion industry
yet.
The whole transactional nature of it has become unpalatable, I think.
Mm-hmm. Fame makes a man think things over. 20 years in the Captain Kirk seat at GQ, that's what's called a good innings. That's a jolly good innings. Magazine editors used to be a 3 or 4 year thing, didn't they? And you've kind of...
Well, I was only meant to be there for 4 years. Everywhere I'd been before, the Sunday Times, Observer, anywhere, I'd only been there for 4 years. Mm. And I think I was attempting to leave about 10 years ago, but then everything changed.
Yeah. Just when you think you've got out, they drag you back in.
And also now it's like being back on a paper and also working on a magazine and working on a radio. It's doing all of those things, because you have to be on every platform all the time. And it's quite strange, because we still take an awful lot of pride putting together these magazines that come out every month. But at the same time, you're trying to compete with people like yourselves, with news organisations, radio, newspapers, by having a website and social platforms which are updated every 5 to 10 minutes, obviously without the resources of some of those media organisations. So you have to target very carefully. You have to have opinions about particular things, but you also need to be able to generate the kind of material which is your DNA. And it's a kind of fascinating period.
Yeah,
actually, because there is a little person on your shoulder whispering in your ear saying, this might not work. So far, it's actually working very, very well because the team is completely engaged and our website is on fire at the moment. But yeah, who knows where we're going to be in 9 months' time? Literally no one knows. And that's what makes it exciting.
Men's magazines have been through about three or four different phases in the time that you've been editing GQ. Do you feel that you've maybe come back to, almost an early arena setup where it's quite an austere version of masculinity? It's not loutish and laddish and overtly sexual.
I wouldn't say it's austere and I wouldn't say it's gone back. But I think what has happened is that the whole sort of undergrowth, that huge groundswell of publishing in this sector in the 90s has just disappeared. I mean, there is no one left. All of those lads mags have disappeared, and there is no one left in our sector, which makes our publishing director sweat occasionally. But I've always maintained that there's nothing wrong with being number one in a market of one.
Yeah, it's astonishing that the way it vanished almost overnight. I remember when there was the Lose the Lad Mag campaign that appeared, but women were saying, take this stuff off the shelves. Just as they were all vanishing, it was like campaigning against dinosaurs after the meteorite had hit. Is it a relief to not have those people sort of elbowing you on the shelves?
Nobody enjoys it when people lose their jobs, but I have to say, as a culture and as a phenomenon, I didn't love that period at all because I found those magazines very reductive. They started to become offensive when they veered into even sort of more ribald territory. And I'm glad they've gone.
Yeah, there are things I miss about the 90s, but that's not it.
Some of the 90s is there on Twitter, I've seen.
Absolutely,
yes, it still exists. Also joining us today is Sophie Harris, writer for Mojo, Rolling Stone and The Guardian, former digital and music editor at Time Out New York, writing and subbing gun for hire, and singer with folk project Springfield, which presumably is not about The Simpsons. She's a Big Mouth regular and we're delighted to have her back. Hello, Sophie.
Hello, I'm so happy to be back.
Wonderful. What pop exciting things have you been up to recently?
What pop exciting things? Mm. Golly. I've been sick, honestly, most of January. So that, like,
is that sick in a youth-speak word?
You know, it's more been like watching, the Bross documentary repeatedly. But I've been listening to Sacred Paws, actually. That's the record that I've been getting into a lot. They've just signed to Merge. They're a Glaswegian lady duo and just like cracking pop songs. And like, as I've been getting better, ooh, I might be ready to skip around in the streets again.
Oh, wonderful.
So, yeah, they're fab.
Now, you're still a yoga teacher. And I really want to know what the best music to do yoga to this year
That depends on the type of yoga that you're doing.
See, if you Google yoga music, you just get a lot of
it's a bit
dreary,
can be awful,
isn't it?
I mean, if I was going to be doing it like an evening, nice, relaxing bit of yoga, then I would go for Music for Airports by Brian Eno. Really can't fault a bit of Eno for your yoga practice.
Oh,
and I
nice.
Actually really love classical music. Is very like for the kind of great swells of music and the breathing and
you would
and
have thought that Eno would have come up with music for yoga by now. You would have thought it's like open goal. Come on, Brian. Get a grip, Brian.
Open
goal.
Every other bass.
I know, yeah. It's like,
And he's doing it.
He's probably on
his mat in the morning.
Oh, I remember.
I want to be your downward dog. Absolutely, yes.
But what I'm thinking about dynamic flow, morning yoga, could you do that to Girls Aloud? You think you could do real pop and fuse yoga?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you could. Yeah. I mean, I really like those sort of slightly nerdy Animal Collective type bands for your dynamic yoga, because it's like very rhythmic and you've got a real like kind of...
I like to move the boot. Sorry.
Yes!
That could be quite good.
God.
Do you know what? I might put together a little dynamic trash pop playlist for yoga and I'll bring it in.
This sounds like one of those terrifying breakfast raves.
This all sounds good to me.
Oh, God, yeah. What are they called? Sunrise. And you get up at, and you go there at five in the morning and everyone's insanely chipper.
If you're still up at five in the morning, that's okay. But not getting up for it. That's what I want.
Earlier this week, I heard you joined Andrew to listen to the Beatles' White Album as you'd never heard it before on very posh Dali loudspeakers for our sister podcast.
They were so posh. They were so posh. And I scooted my way, so I was sitting like the... You know those nerdy the diagrams from when everyone first got into stereos and you had to sit in that perfect kind of long triangle? I sat in the special place. I mean, it's just such a joy to listen to that record anyway. It's one of those records that you know you love and therefore don't listen to it inexplicably for long periods of time. But it did sound sparkly, did it not?
It did indeed. That'll be on a future edition of our Be There with Dali Loudspeakers podcast coming soon. Plug, plug, plug. On this week's show, The Defiant Ones, HBO's documentary about the parallel rise of Beats billionaires Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine, am I saying it right, makes it to the BBC at last. What does it tell us about the shape and the fate of the music business? Cosmic New York upstaters Mercury Rev have flipped the whole record an album in its entirety thing by recording somebody else's album in its entirety. Does their bucolic psychedelic take on the Delta Suite, originally by elusive country visionary Bobby Gentry, take us into a parallel America? And how do they persuade Nora Jones, Lucinda Williams, Vashti Bunyan, Rachel Goswell from Slowdive and loads of other top female voices to participate? And finally, the 40th birthday re-releases of the Buzzcocks' first two albums gain unfortunate poignancy after the unexpected death of Pete Shelley. How could one band record two such incredible records in less than 12 months? And which associated band nearly recruited Dylan as its drummer? All this after a quick reminder from Sean.
If you enjoy Big Mouth, remember you can get each show a whole day early if you support us on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. All we're asking for is the equivalent of the price of a pint each month. That's £5 because it's an artisan pint of beer. It's a nice one. In return for helping us cover our studio costs, you'll get every episode hot off the editing suite and, of course, the extra bit. Every week we record a little bit of additional conversation just for Patreon listeners. Dylan and Sophie will be sticking around to talk about the best and worst people they've interviewed during their time at the coalface of pop culture journalism. Just search Patreon Big Mouth or go to the Big Mouth Facebook page to find out more. All we're saying is, buy us a pint.
Okay, HBO's The Defiant Ones, the story of how Jimmy Iovine, still hope I'm saying it right, and Dr. Dre rose within and ultimately transformed the music business. It's coming to BBC Four next week after making an enormous splash on Netflix. Directed by Alan Hughes of Menace to Society fame, it weaves together two contrasting stories, that of the son of a white Brooklyn docker and the son of a black single mother from Compton, Los Angeles. It becomes an almost complete vision of American music and culture since the 1960s, and it's not short on access, with Eminem, Bruce Springsteen, Ice Cube, Stevie Nicks and Tom Petty all taking the £100 and a lukewarm Costa coffee that usually goes to people like me and Sean when we appear on Now That's What I Call the 50 Worst Records from Hell in History Ever on Channel 5. Let's have a taste.
Let's cut to the chase. Boom.
We're talking about Jimmy and Dr. Dre.
Jimmy Iovine is the levitator. Dre is the innovator.
I need something a little bit more impressive.
I have to work harder than the next guy, and to do better than the next guy, I have to kill.
I knew that I had to be a success at something. A friend of mine put together two turntables. I started doing this thing. I wanted to be able to get in there and rock.
Sophie Harris, this one goes in feet first. It starts with a $3 billion Apple deal to buy Beats being leaked because Dre's mate Tyrese is drunk on Twitter, and then it ramps up from there. What did you make of it? Did you enjoy it?
Did I enjoy it? Yes, I did. When it first came on the screen and you get this warning saying, you know, it may contain, no, well, does contain nudity, gore, self-harm. And I thought, oh, blimey. And I didn't see any of those things feature in the first couple of episodes, I don't think. But maybe we're just inured to that kind of thing. We don't notice it anymore. It is. It's a really exciting beginning. And they also have this, the roll call of all the people who are going to appear in the series sitting down in their chairs and getting comfortable. And is this my best angle? And you're like, ooh, wow.
Overture, yes. Yeah. Mm. Did you feel you learned something about the differences in the American music business and ours?
Did I? I mean, I guess in a way I kind of feel like the American music business is our music business just because there's so much crossover and culturally, you know, we're not talking about some random obscure little strand of American culture. It's the stuff that most British teenagers were into at the time and still kind of rifle around in.
Mm. Dylan, you've seen the whole series on Netflix. What's your take on the Defiant Ones?
This is written like it's like a novel, because the filmmakers have taken various aspects and these characters in the music business, and they've sort of created their own narrative. They've sort of created their own story. And because the narrative arc of great pop music seems to be coming to an end, writers, publishers, documentary makers are looking at that period and finding new stories to tell. Because 10 years ago, you'd have a documentary about a particular person, and that would be it. So there's sort of two themes. You've got people making documentaries which are far more tabloid, like the Michael Jackson documentaries, Amy Winehouse, et cetera, et cetera. But something like this is quite complex. And they're making a narrative out of already existing stories. That, I think, is interesting. The second thing is the vast amount of money they spend on it. Fantastic budgets. Yeah. That's brilliant, because still most pop documentaries, most documentaries about this world, particularly if they're made for BBC Four, look like they've had fourpence spent on them. This hasn't.
Yeah.
And it just shows what you can do with very smart people and a lot of money.
And an awful lot of contacts as well, because they're kind of, just the sight of... Bruce Springsteen saying, well, Jimmy's only doing this because of his personal insecurities, isn't he? It's kind of gold in its way. I agree with you that there is a great deal of, there's a great deal of massaging of the narrative here. It has to be the great American novel. It has to be, as you're quite right to say, the era of great pop is sort of coming to at least an interim conclusion. So we're seeing it from the beginning to the zenith, to the end with these guys. Both of them have reached the top, and I thought Dre gave the impression of actually not really knowing what to do with himself now he's at the top. You know, he was never kind of expecting these billions.
I don't feel any great sympathy for him.
No, my heart's not breaking. But
I think that you can, you could take other figures that have got even more of a sort of sweep. People like Quincy Jones, and you could marry Quincy Jones with half a dozen people that pepper his career from the 50s right up into the current day. I just thought it was a very clever and engaging piece of film. Yeah. And I think it's sort of set another benchmark for how these things can be in the future. And the next time you watch a Fleetwood Mac documentary, you don't want it to be chronological and orthodox with the same sort of the same sort of material that you would see in an old-fashioned magazine feature. I think it's exactly the same way as all of us want to keep writing about these great heroes from the past. And I think Mojo is actually a very good example. If you're writing about anyone, Jim Morrison, yeah, in Mojo, for instance, now, how is that feature going to be different to one you would write 30 years ago? It has to be different. It needs to be different. And you need to layer it with different things. You need to attack the story in a different way. Mm. And I think it raises everyone's game.
Yeah. The interesting thing as well to me is that in a magazine feature, if you were to connect the events of, say, Dr. Dre's career with the social history of Los Angeles and Black America, it would probably lie on the page a little bit. You might be able to drop a couple of shots of the Los Angeles riots in to illustrate what happened with NWA. But here, they're going straight into the footage, the kind of granularity of that news footage, and that, the actuality of being there in a way that kind of punches a lot harder than me saying, oh, and by the way, the police were jolly bad in Los Angeles in the 1990s.
Absolutely. And there's this kind of amazing intimacy to it. And because they've been given this kind of absolutely unrestricted access. But again, as Dylan was saying, it's the high budget, but it's also, you can tell that the people who made it had so much affection for their subject, which is totally different from someone being sycophantic. But so, for example, when you have Dre talking about different ways of scratching and kind of working with music, there'll be subtle little things when he's talking where they give those treatments to his voice. It will slow down a little bit, or it'll pan from either side. And it's just, when something is made with love, it just is completely different.
Those are the moments I really loved, actually, because every band on the way up, every musical artist on the way up, or even an engineer like Irvine, whose name I've just pronounced in the third way, Eovine,
Let's mix it up.
On the you know, the early part of the story is always the absolutely most charming, isn't it? And to see Dre's world-class wrecking crew in their terrible clothes and Dr. Dre in his purple silk lab outfit DJing.
And his surgeon's outfit is sparkly.
It's so corny and it's so amazing. Cheesy, but you absolutely love him for it. And the fact that, like, you see that pretty much every musician starting out has the same, I have no idea what's going to happen here, I'm just going to give it a go.
Yeah.
But you touched on the point of the, you know, the idea of, you know, access without sycophancy. And we've all seen a lot of rock documentaries that are co-produced with the subject, and you kind of think they're going pretty easy on them here.
Yeah. Mm.
I didn't get the impression with this, and I think later on, when we look at the episode, Dylan, you'll have seen this, when we look at the episodes of Dr. Dre assaulting a female journalist, I've not got that far in the series, but apparently it doesn't flinch at all, and it was an absolute precondition of Alan Hughes that he would only do this if Dre would talk about that episode.
I think this has often been the case in documentaries, but now when you're working with people, and traditionally, particularly in our world, there would be a sort of separation between church and state. This is what we're doing in order to make you look like this. But actually, that whole process now is what people want to, and they don't just want it, they demand it, and they're quite right to. And there's a... it's not an era of transparency. We live in a far more transparent age. For instance, when we're doing a cover shoot now, whether it's for the website or whether it's for the magazine, part and parcel of the actual image is the process. Mm. Everything is filmed. Everything is filmed from when someone wakes up to when someone is clearing the table of film canisters and teacups. And everything is captured because you need so much more material now for social, for Instagram feeds, for Twitter, for plus all the material you'll need for the website. And
it's like use
the
whole buffalo these days, though, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know,
you eat the entire animal.
Yeah,
you eat the entire animal. Very well put.
Mm. Sean, what did you make of this documentary?
I think what we're talking about here, you know, unwrapping everything and deconstructing everything, it's really important when they have the family members. So you've got...
Dr. Dre's mum.
Yeah, Dr. Dre's mum, who is an absolute heroine. She is wonderful. But you've also got Jimmy Iovine's sister and mum. Mm-hmm. And they're giving you the background, saying, we're really worried about him eating. So he used to go over to California, make sure he was fed, that he was all right, that he wasn't drinking too much. And that's where it starts to become... The reverence has to go, doesn't it? When you've got your mum saying, mm-hmm. well, you know, and then this happened, this happened, and I was worried that he didn't have a proper tea. That sort of thing is the thing that takes all that ballast out of it, which makes it, again, it softens something that could be quite hard. But also, we're not talking about counterculture. This is mainstream stuff. Mm. And I think sometimes the mainstream doesn't go explored enough.
Yeah.
It's, that's success. This is what people do. This is what we aspire to. But there are the real stories underneath.
Yeah.
How you discover someone, try and make them famous, and then they have a massive car crash. Those sorts of things that happen. The stories keep folding. It's the American dream, the great American novel. Mm. And there was a point where I thought, this is just going on so long. We could have done this in an hour. I thought, no, you're missing the point.
Yeah.
You miss that. It's about it unravelling
and
unfolding. Yeah.
The thing that I thought also was interesting about the whole, you know, America's love for the American dream, but actually I thought it was testament to great parenting. You know, she's a single mum in Compton, but she gives
Bernie.
Him this, like, strength and belief in himself. You know, and then Jimmy Iovine's dad brings him up thinking, you're a gift. When you walk into the room, you make that room better. He's raised thinking that, and you know, you don't get that far, I think, without developing that kind of confidence. The other thing that I thought was interesting is about Jimmy Iovine particularly, is it seems like his greatest gift is as a connector, not actually as a musical visionary. And it doesn't make him a worse producer for not being a musical visionary, but it's his ability to connect in every way. So the physical connection, so-and-so talk to so-and-so, the ability to see the connections, if you play the bongos louder, this will happen. And I feel like the architecture of the program is kind of testament to that, because it's like, if Jimmy says he's doing it, then sure, all the people he's ever connected will trust him and connect up and be honest.
So rock and roll parents evening, and do your best work you possibly can. I think this is an all around the table
there
thumbs up, I think, isn't it? The listeners should be watching this show, without a doubt. Now,
absolutely. Let's put our 40s down and get back from the hood and have some music chosen by one of our guests in their editor's recommendation. This time, they actually are an editor for a change. Dylan Jones, what have you brought in for us?
This is a song called The World is Crowded by Unknown Mortal Orchestra. I know nothing about this other than I was in a hotel in Paris last week. And whenever I hear these days, because the entire musical output of my world is controlled by my teenage daughters, that I almost never listen to music. So whenever I hear something, I Shazam it. And for me, Shazam is like Eurostar. I still think that the Eurostar is like a 1950s idea of the future. The fact that you can get on a train in one country and go under the sea and get off in another country, for me, and I'm not being cute, I still think it's a fantastic thing. And to be able, I remember the first time someone said, oh, you can Shazam that, and I didn't know what they meant. And they showed me how to do it, and I said, how do they do that? And I still get an incredibly childish thrill for getting that connection. And I know nothing about this record other than I like it.
Well, hats off to the little old lady in the Shazam office who listens and she quickly riffles through.
Looks through the files.
Love her. She's brilliant. I want her.
Love
to.
Her.
We love her. Here we go. This is Unknown Mortal Orchestra with The World Is Crowded.
The world is crowded.
Now, into the misty pines in the American subconscious as seasoned space cadets Mercury Rev go in search, metaphorically speaking, of country phantom Bobby Gentry. She recorded the Delta Suite, a concept album about life in the American South in 1968, hot off the success of Ode to Billy Joe, He Who Jumped Off the Tallahassee Bridge, and it flopped horrendously, which of course gives it all the romance and lost classic status you could wish for. The Rev, on the other hand, have fought for years to match their own self-reinvention on Deserters Songs, which was back in 1999. Is this a perfect match of material and soundcraft? Let's have a taste. This is Mercury Rev with guest vocalist Suzanne Sundfuhr doing Tobacco Road.
Only you know how I love this place called Tobacco Road.
Mercury Rev sing Bobby Gentry. This is one of those projects where you think, what? And then a minute later you think, yeah, good idea. Sophie Harris, are you a Mercury Rev fan to start with?
I was for the first three albums, which I loved and thought were magical and captivating and weird and beautiful. And then my interest kind of trailed off a little bit. And I do absolutely love Bobby Gentry and this record and her story and her crazy life and marrying three people in 10 years and then disappearing off and being a recluse. So I wasn't excited to press play because I feel like when these projects have been done before, they quite often are less than the sum of their parts. You know, you have a, say you have the Leonard Cohen tribute album, I'm Your Fan. Like, of course it's not going to be as good as a Leonard Cohen album, but it's still kind of, you know, an interesting thing. So I was intrigued. And I think it's a noble effort, and I don't think it's even a patch on the Delta Suite.
But is it good in its own right?
Is it good in its own right? I mean, sure. If I was sitting in a cafe listening to it, I would think, oh, this is, you know, cool. That's a cool record, you know. But I think because I really, really love the Delta Suite, and there's so much to love about it, you know, her voice is, it's, she just has one of the most beautiful voices recorded, I think. And she sings so close to the mic, and she has total confidence in the loveliness of her voice. And the orchestrations are particularly beautiful. And so when you have a song like Courtyard, which for my money is the best song in the original album, if you want to listen to just one song of that album, and it's covered here by Beth Orton, and I think the some tracks work much better than others, But the ones that don't really work, like with Beth Orton, or I hate to say it, Lucinda Williams, it's because they're kind of, they're giving it their best, you know, and Beth Orton's trying to make it into a kind of torch song, and it all becomes a bit overwrought. And actually, the beauty of Bobby Gentry songs is the restraint, you know, it's like so subtle and so elegant, and that's what gives it their kind of emotional heft, really. Mm-hmm. And so it can get a bit like, you know, the kind of, I think, reverence can be a really great thing to bring to music, and it also can kind of take away from this sort of vulnerability and honesty sometimes.
So what I like about it is the best parts of this is when they just veer right off the script and take the songs into their own cosmic strings and horns, and out in the pines, you know, doing acid in the Adirondacks or whatever they used to do in their youth. Particularly the track Reunion, which listeners will probably know is the one that Rudimental borrowed from for Mama Do the Hump, Mama Do the Hump, Mama Mama Do the Hump, which, and you and the original, it's very much like that, but they do a version with Rachel Goswell from Slow Dive, which is some kind of, you know, what would the upstate New York version of shoegazing be? Boot gazing, hoof gazing. So there's a bit of hoof gazing on it.
Goat gazing.
It abandons that original rhythm and just spirals off into this kind of very slow divey, very grand orchestra, very hallucinogenic thing, which I think really works. I think. I mean, I'm a sucker for their sound. I'm a sucker for, you know, wandering the woods of the imagination with Grasshopper and Jonathan Donahue
that sort
and
of stargazing, mad horns. Twinkly feel. Sure. But again, I do think the some tracks work much better than others. And some I was really surprised by. Like, I really liked the Letitia Sadier song. That was really kind of swoony and not at all what I would have expected from her. The Vashti Bunyan cover is absolutely lovely because she's got this kind of that same sort of vulnerability and sort of wobbliness, which I liked. And Phoebe Bridges as well. Hers was good.
I was surprised that I'm not a Norah Jones fan. Mm-hmm. Never have been. But I see she has her place. She's quite successful, I've heard, as well.
If you like that sort of thing.
And I have a deep fondness for this album. I used to play all the time in the 90s. We discovered early listening. There was a group of us, and it was sad. But I had this on nonstop, and so I was expecting to really, really hate it.
Were you?
But the start of Oklahoma River Bottom Band and Norah Jones' voice, I just thought, well, that, to me, I mean, you could just release that one song. It is really powerful. And again, it's not overwrought, it's not overdone, it's not oversung, which I thought it was going
to
be.
Yeah, she's great for not oversinging.
But
she?
As it went on, as we're saying, the ones that don't sound like anything like the album, I really enjoyed. And I had to skip Courtyard with Beth Orton because I love the song so much I didn't want to listen to a cover of it because I don't think that you can make it any better. Now, Dylan Jones, I don't think you've listened to it, but is it something that you would listen to? Is this something you would think, that's a good idea, let's redo Bobby Gentry?
The way that you've all described it and the fact that you're all sort of rapturous about it does make me intrigued. Normally, I hate these ideas because I think that it's like the director who remade Psycho.
Yes.
It seems sort of pointless and it seems like a sort of reductive thing to do, but it sounds fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I think they have actually taken it away in a properly, genuinely, fulfillingly weird direction, and certainly they've been very active in the transfer market, haven't they? Because as well as Norah Jones, Hope Sandoval and Beth Orton, Lucinda Williams, Rachel Goswell, Vashti Bunyan. My favourite is Carice Van Houten, aka Melisandre from Game of Thrones.
Oh yes,
you know, kind of nudist Kate Bush from Game of Thrones. She's always doing magic, and she's on it, and she does
the
Parchment
Red Witch.
Farm. The Red Witch. She does Parchment Farm, and she sort of turns it from a like, you know, your standard yokel shoot one another type of thing into this American Gothic cosmic parable of the subconscious and the unconscious. And she sort of Nico's it a bit. She's not a capital S singer, much as Letitia Sadia Nico's it up a bit on her tune.
Very Nico,
But I thought it was fantastic. I thought it was really...
I think if you're going to do cover versions... I like it when a cover version is radical. Mm. I remember when Devo did Satisfaction, and the whole point of the Rolling Stones Satisfaction is it's a guitar riff, and you make that record without the guitar riff, and it's all about the rhythm. That's brilliant. Last summer, I was just finishing a big book on Wichita Lineman, and there is a band who do an hour version of Wichita Lineman. It's an hour long. And we were on
holiday for an encore. What did they do for an encore? An hour-long version.
We were on holiday last summer, and I needed some time in the day with my family to listen to this song. And they all went off to the beach, and I was working away, playing this song. And they came back, and my wife said, "So how was it?" And I said, "I did about 40 minutes.
But you've got it that far. You've got it. You can see the end in sight by that. It's like
exactly,
going on a country walk, surely.
Yeah.
Can you remember the name of the band? I'm sure hour-long versions of
it's
which
out
are
there
still on the ground.
It's out there in the dark recesses of the internet.
This sounds like my cup of tea.
Now, obviously, there are a lot of ladies on this record.
I loved that.
Do you not think there was any point where they could get some bloke?
Well, yeah. Do you know, that's really funny asked, because I was thinking about just that. I loved that it was all women, and I loved that it's kind of an embarrassment of riches in terms of just the sheer vocal talent. It's like, oh, yeah, there's loads of brilliant
binders
women singers.
Binders full of women.
Yeah, I did like that. I liked that it was all women singing. I mean, partly because the album, obviously, she is a woman. But I liked that it was all women. What, did you feel like you could have done with the chapel?
I wanted a little subversion. I wanted a nice soprano.
Did you want the obligatory Anthony Johnson's track?
He's or the only person I think of who would have done it. Yes. Or you'd have said Iggy Pop. No, I didn't want
Well, actually, all collaborative albums by law have to have an Iggy track. They have to have a David Byrne track.
Yes.
That's kind of a statutory EU regulation or something like that.
Absolutely. So what do we think? You're going to go and listen to it, I hope, Mr. Jones.
I will.
Yeah, good.
I think
you've
it's
told
great.
Me to.
Yes, I have. I told you to. Yeah.
I think it's great. I think all the songs sound like they made for HBO trailers about murders in the Adirondacks and the Pines. I think they all sound like, you know, true crime themes. So it's right up my street.
Is it the kind of music that you could hear if you were watching Ozark?
Probably. Yes. I would have thought it is. It's the kind
Does that imply that you don't watch Ozark?
I don't watch Ozark, but I've got a rough idea
You're
what Ozark's
a bad
all about.
Person, Andrew Harrison.
It's hours in the day. I've only just started on Fargo. Come on, give me a break.
My question was, what next? Tortoise, do surround yourself with Scylla.
I'd listen to that.
Would you? Smog.
Yes, absolutely.
Girls Aloud. Okay.
Okay, let's get off the edge of the Tallahassee Bridge for a minute and have another track from one of our guests, Sophie Harris. What have you brought in for us to listen to?
What have I brought in? I've brought in the new single from Vampire Weekend, Harmony Hall.
Mm-hmm.
I love it very much. I love them. And do you know what I was thinking? I was listening to it as I was walking across Trafalgar Square, blazing sunshine. Oh, lovely, all the little classical flourishes. And I thought, songwriting. If I was in some kind of terrible scenario where my life depended on a really good song, who would I, like a bit like Phone a Friend, like who would I draft in to write me a solid song? I'd get Vampire Weekend. The quality of the songwriting is just phenomenal. You know, there's the brainy lyrics, but actually in terms of like tunes and construction and melody and playing, like they're a really tight band as well. And I remember thinking some years ago that maybe there's some kind of connection in the American work ethic and the quality of musicianship in American bands, because they're really tight. And when they play live, it's... You know.
Lazy British workers, you see. You know, on the cup by. That'll finish when Brexit happens.
So, yeah, this is the first single from the album, which will come out in spring, and it's their first record in 6 years. And Rostam is not officially in the band. He's the sort of twiddly, harpsichordy loving one. He made his solo record last year, but he does play on this album.
First record in 6 years, not that hardworking then, after all. This is Vampire Weekend with Harmony Hall. In the stone walls of Harmony Hall. Snakes inside a place you thought was dignified. I don't wanna live like this, but I don't wanna die. I don't wanna live like this, but I don't wanna die. Finally, the 40th anniversary reissue of a brace of classic punk albums would be interesting but not seismic news if not for the untimely death of a much-loved artist like Pete Shelley. The Buzzcocks frontman passed away from a heart attack at just 63 on December the 6th, making the reissues of their debut and its follow-up especially poignant. What set the Buzzcocks apart? What makes those first two records so amazing? And where can we hear their echoes? Firstly, we didn't just want to play Ever Fallen in Love like everybody does, so from Another Music in a Different Kitchen, here's Autonomy, and from Love Bites, it's ESP. Thank you. Hands up who wishes it was 1978 again. Me, I wish it was 1978. Dylan, you're especially keen to talk Buzzcocks. What set them apart from that punk crop in your mind?
The thing about the first album is that we'd only just got used to this radical shift where everything had to be short, mm-hmm. everything had to be unsophisticated and sort of badly produced. That was one of the sort of punk sort of DIY things that everything had to sound sort of handmade. And then you listen to the first Buzzcocks album and it's sort of bewildering because it's so brilliantly produced, it's so complex, and it does what Wire were attempting to do, but it does it in a far more sophisticated way. Plus you had amazing melody, old-fashioned melody, Beatles-esque melody, and lyrics that were, on the one hand, talking about teenage life, but on the other, in that brilliant way that great writers can, writing about it from a distance as though the person writing those lyrics was 60 or 70, with an age of experience. And it was just an amazingly complex record. Still, I mean, sonically, it's still so, so good today. Such an important record. And even though the second record is poppier and it contains Ever Fallen in Love, it's obviously, it's a sort of 60% as good as the first album. That first album is a masterpiece.
To me, the thing that always stood out about the Buzzcocks was, you know, I was a little bit too young for punk. It seemed frightening and, you know, kind of a bit older than me and a bit intimidating. But the Buzzcocks were always fun and funny. They had wit. They had humour. It was life-affirming. And then the older you get, you understand more about Pete Shelley and his character and his background and the fact that he's a bisexual bloke in a still very masculine punk world. And that sort of, you know, the marriage of that and the native Mancunian wit just really shone out to me and made it a very appealing record. You know, you never thought the Clash were never going to crack a joke for you. But you felt that, you know, Pete Shelley was an entertaining bloke to be around as well.
I think you're right, because obviously in terms of optics, if you look at the imagery of that time, everybody had to be photographed in a certain way, almost always black and white, moody. No one ever smiled in photographs. And they attempted, I say they, United Artists or whoever, or management, attempted to do this with the Buzzcocks. So if you look at the imagery, in fact, you look at the picture on the first album, and they do look a bit shifty, they look austere, they look difficult. But as you say, you scratch underneath the surface, and they're like the Monkees. They just happen to be producing this incredibly sophisticated, powerful, edgy, and actually quite dangerous music.
And also the kind of the artwork, the kind of Malcolm Garrett sort of super pop-up, Technicolor. I think one of the later albums when they reunited was called Trade Test Transmissions. You know, that idea that it was test card pop. It was technology, but it was bright. It was kind of
very, very pop. So I remember, I think, I should have checked before coming here, but I think on the second album there's an instrumental called Walking Distance.
Yeah.
I think it's called Walking Distance.
Is it Walking Away from the Pulse or something?
But I remember, because I was at St. Martin's when this came out, and I remember making an animation for that song. God, I wish I still had it. I mean, I'm sure it wasn't very good, but I remember that you'd take the sort of themes and the tropes from the design, from Garrett, Malcolm,
Malcolm Garrett,
all of that stuff, and it still feels, and those amazing shirts that Pete Shelley used to wear, very modernist. There was a real sense of difference about that whole period, actually.
Shirts are buttoned up weirdly. Sophie, the kind of really received wisdom of this is that, like, the first one is them trying to do thrashy punk, but being too emotional and sensitive and actually funny to kind of fulfil the brief. And then the second album is...
That's harsh.
I'm saying it's the received wisdom. That's why they're brilliant. I mean, getting it wrong in your own way is what makes great pop, what makes great art. I think that's what makes them good.
100%.
And then the received wisdom, the second one, is that they then realise they can actually write great love songs, and they write some great love songs. Because love songs were not allowed under punk, were they? It was kind of against the law.
Yeah, and I think that's what I've always been very fond of the Buzzcocks for. I'm not like a huge fan, but I remember growing up in the 80s in suburbia, and our next door neighbours, the daughter who was a teenager. I remember when Molly became a punk and she had a mohawk and everything. And I remember thinking, ooh, that's a bit scary. What's punk? And then a bit later, going to Rock Circus in, do you remember, in the Trocadero? And they had a sort of animatronic Johnny Rotten and Paul Gambaccini's voiceover going, look at him. He hates you. I'm not sure about this punk business. No. You know, and seeing the Sex Pistols and thinking, oh. And then you hear the Buzzcocks and it's all heart, you know. Yeah. And there's so much tenderness and with this urgency. And that's what I love them for.
Point of order, Dylan's just found the album on Spotify. That track is indeed called Walking Distance. I got it wrong and he can remember it perfectly. We still want to see this animation.
Iovine. Say it again.
Iovine. Iovine.
Iovine.
Iovine. Iovine. Sophie, you know, Ever Fallen in Love is clearly the emblematic tune of theirs, but the kind of lovelorn aspect of the Buzzcocks is another huge standout bit. And what do I get in particular? I just want a lover like any other. What do I get? I only get Sleepless Nights. It's both teenage moaning, but also kind of adult sort of longing put together beautifully.
Yeah.
In the same song.
Also, I really love a question in a pop song, and I hate a bad question, like the Christmas song of "Are you hanging your stocking on the wall? Does he ride a red-nosed reindeer?" It's on and on, these inane, stupid questions.
Are you
and
knocking
that
Slade?
That's some of the best questioning.
I'm not having
in a
you
song.
Knocking Slade.
I'm afraid it's happening. No, it's happening now.
You two break it up.
Sean, what did you make of this immensely famous diptych?
I loved it. I haven't listened to it for years, and you put it on, and it is. I use the word fresh advisedly, but especially the first track, first album, Fast Cars. I hate Fast Cars. That's punk. That's the template of punk. There's nothing more than that. And to hear that and to hear it as if it was recorded yesterday. I say that like an old person, but it's joyous. You say it's the wit that they have. And this, but there's also the confusion. There's the I'm sitting alone in my bedroom and nobody loves me stuff. That's pop music.
Yeah.
That's it to a T. And it's just so engaging.
But
I loved it.
Fast Cars is so brilliant because they kind of weaponize their weediness, don't they?
They kind absolutely. Of, and it's called Fast Cars, so I think it's going to be about
anti hairy bloke rock, anti Corvettes and Stingrays, anti I love my car, anti the Queen type sound. And it's so funny, but my favourite of the lot in this is on 16, which, as you were just saying, Dylan, is an older person writing about themselves when they were young. And it finishes, and I hate modern music, disco, boogie and pop. They go on and on and on and on and on. How I wish they would stop. And
it's this quite
is
Adrian
so
Moore.
Perfect.
And then it does.
And it stops. Yeah. It's just so great. And it's like they clearly understand everything that's great about pop music and they're not frightened to say what's crap about pop music. Although, of course, they and I love disco, boogie and pop. But there is a moment when you just want to say, shut up, close down the outside world.
But also, it's incredibly loud. If you listen, you talk about it sounds incredibly fresh. You listen to that record and it's like listening to Queens of the Stone Age or something. It's so pure and loud and noisy.
Is that? I mean, it would be trite to say, is that Diggle's rock sensibility coming against the more sensitive aspect of Pete Shelley? Well, clearly they're all a bit sensitive in the band, and they all like to rock as well. That's what makes the Buzzcocks the Buzzcocks.
Yeah, I mean, they are a pop group.
Yeah,
you know, and we're talking about all this layering, but they are a sort of quintessential four-piece rock group who make that fantastic noise.
But you'd also have to shout over an audience. They've played live. They know that you have to have a wall of sound to play for a punk audience. So they're taking that and putting that directly in the studio. No noodling around. I love the guitar solos. You know, just listen to the two or three notes.
Yeah, one note.
Absolutely.
Also, on the second album, there's a song, a Steve Diggle song, where he plays acoustic, and you can see that they're rushing through the expectancies of what punk should be, and it's like the Clash doing Police and Thieves because they need more songs. And it's like, why don't the Buzzcocks say, well, should we do an acoustic song? And they do it. It's not very good, but it's a sort of novelty. But you can see the thought processes. Damn it, let's do an acoustic song.
And they did two albums in 1 year, This is like knocking on the door of 40 songs amazing. When you add in all the various B-sides and stuff. The work rate is incredible. To me, it's a bit like when the Smiths would be able to bang out three great songs and one of them would only be on the 12-inch, but it doesn't matter because there'll be another one along in 6 weeks.
Yeah.
You know, an absolute confidence in themselves. And ability to just bang it out. I listened to nothing else but the Buzzcocks yesterday and it was brilliant.
Quite right, too.
I felt like about 14 again. I loved them so much.
16 again.
Well, yeah. Early developer. Well, late developer. Who do we think? Where are the echoes of the Buzzcocks now? Or should there be more? Are there not enough? It's dead air in the studio.
Nobody's... I don't know. I was going to say it's terribly Franz Ferdinand. A lot of this stuff, you realise who they've influenced. But is that just who they've influenced? Do we need people to pretend to be the Buzzcocks? No, go and listen to the Buzzcocks, please. Oh, sorry, Buzzcocks.
Buzzcocks. I think we need people to think like Buzzcocks, not to sound like Buzzcocks.
You know, just to be Buzzcocks.
Well, to just go like, I can do this thing and I have confidence in my personality and I've got a healthy, not cynicism, but I'm alive to the absurdity of the world around me and I'm going to do some pop songs about it. Bang it out.
I think that actually, to go back to that band Sacred Pause, that's what I dig about them, is that there's a kind of, let's get on with it, but also there's like a buoyancy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like which is, like you want to dance to the Buzzcocks.
There's power, there's that energy behind it. It's vital, man.
You used the word dig in an unironic way there.
Lived in America, innit?
Love that. Love that. But you mentioned the Smiths, and they're very similar to the Smiths. Well, they're not in so many ways. I mean, not musically.
Well, they are in many ways.
But
that sort of
distance, the irony, it's heartfelt, but it's quizzical.
Mm.
It's tough, but it's beautiful. Mm. And it's asexual.
Yeah.
Well, I think they were one of the few bands also that managed a dignified afterlife because they got back together again after about 15 years or something, didn't they? And made some pretty good records. And poor old Pete, it's such a shame. You know, he should have had another 15, 20 years of being rediscovered again and again by...
Nice man as well.
Absolutely. I was playing my Buzzcocks records on iTunes and then as it got to the end, the voice of Pete Shelley popped up because I had an interview with Pete Shelley that I'd done years ago that I'd totally forgotten about. Really kind of, you know, brought me up really short, that did. Anyway, Buzzcocks. Four thumbs up around the table. Before we finish, it's about time Sian got to choose a track. What have you brought in for us?
I've brought in Opening by Gamelan Pacifica.
What is this, you massive hippie?
Well, this is because it's January and it's cold and I sit in bed quite a lot. It's like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Thousands of people in bed because it's so cold. Aww. I listen to Late Junction and all the esoteric music comes out in January. Late Junction, I know, obviously, is a...
It's posh John Peel.
Yeah,
it's totally posh John Peel.
Probably as well. But let's give a shout out to Freaky Music. And this is the Philip Glass track Opening. I like a bit of Glass, but it can go a bit Nora Jones, you know what I mean? But this is fantastic. Gamelan Pacifica are from Seattle. They play regularly in Seattle. Thinks of moving to Seattle. It sounds like nothing else. I just couldn't stop playing it the first time I heard it. Perfect for that just late January. It's cold. It's warm in this bed. Let's listen to some Gamelan.
Well, Gamelan a ding dong. It's Sean's choice. Gamelan Pacifica with Opening. It's the end of the show, which means closing time chatter. What will our guests be discussing with Mercury Rev over a sidecar on the Hudson Line to Poughkeepsie? Sophie Harris, what's your closing time chatter?
The docu-movie Three Identical Strangers, which I believe is currently airing on Netflix. It's just fantastic. You can't take your eyes off it. It's the true story of triplets who were born... And you know what? If you don't want to know anything about this, pop your earplugs in, because I'm going to tell you a little bit. Three triplets born in New York, put up for adoption in various different homes.
Yeah.
The parents didn't know that they were triplets. And so the way that the movie opens is one of them Bobby going to college for the first time, walks into college and everyone's like, hey, how are you doing? Girl gives him a big kiss. Like, it's so good to see you. Hey, Eddie. And he's thinking, why are they calling me Eddie? And then someone walks into the room and says, is your birthday July 12th? And he's like, yes. You know, were you born in New York? Yes, I was. I think you have a twin, an identical twin. So you start with the twins and the twin story goes, you know, what was viral in the 80s. And then you find out that actually there's a triplet. They all meet, they become the talk of the town. And as we were saying with the Dre Iving documentary, there's all this kind of amazing like energy at the beginning. Like, yeah, you know, and Madonna puts them in a movie. They're all like, hey, checking out Madonna, because they're cute. They're like these cute 18-year-olds having a laugh. And then, you know, like all kind of good real fairy tales, it goes
horribly wrong.
And very complex. Why were they separated? What was going on? You know, let's have a look at what kind of homes they were brought up in. There's the working class blue collar home. There's the middle class home. And there's the fancy home. Why were they being assessed by scientists every month or so?
Ooh, this sounds
like
a feature shock.
Watch that documentary.
Sounds amazing. Sean, what's your closing time chatter?
Mine is Buzzcocks related, because Linda Sterling has had her biggest workout yet. She is the photo montage artist who did the Buzzcocks Orgasm Addict sleeve that you will be aware of. Big pal of the Smiths, as we know. But she has now 12 million editions of artwork, as in she has done the new Tube Map, London Friends.
That's amazing.
Which is amazing. They print 12 million every year of her photo montage. And there's an enormous exhibition. It was open in November, but in Southwark, all around Southwark Tube Station, is her photo montage artwork, some of it culled from TfL archive and the Lost Property Archive, and she's been working on it. It's amazing. And just to see, you can't see this, listeners, but
the listeners watching in black and white,
it's hers is very erotic.
It's a cutout. It's a cutout smiling mouth, very orgasmatic.
Yes, but
actually,
with the mouth going into it, it's really lovely. And I keep going to the gym collecting them. Don't know why I need 10, but maybe I need 10 more. Anyway, that's Linda Sterling's stuff. And so, hooray for Linda for sort of reinventing herself.
Come to London, people.
She seemed to hide for a while and wasn't around, and now she's around.
Come to London and get some free art, people.
Yeah.
Dylan Jones, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, I'm usually only of help to people I know once a year, which is when people ask me what books they should buy people for Christmas. And it's reminded me of a book, my favourite book of last year, which I still don't think has got enough attention, a book by Duncan Hannah called 20th Century Boy. And it's a memoir of an American artist. And it's almost like a sort of parallel history of New York in the early 70s.
Wow.
Because even though Duncan Hannah isn't a household name, and he was someone that I wasn't aware of until I read this book, the people he bumps into and the people he meets and the people he hangs out with, everyone from everyone involved in the sort of CBGB world to Andy Warhol, is a bold-faced name. So you're reading this fascinating story of this person you might not be aware of, and yet he's bumping into and having relationships with and meals with and parties with all of these fascinating people who are sort of, they make up the DNA of New York
but
in
so
the early
like
70s.
It could be you, because you don't know who he is. You can put yourself in his position.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that. Mm. Yes.
So what's it called again?
It's called 20th Century Boy by Duncan Hannah.
Fantastic. Well, my closing time chatter is James Burke's Web of Knowledge on Radio 4, the little 15 minutes after, I think it's after World at One. If you're old enough, if you're listening to this show, you're old enough to remember James Burke's connections on the telly, where he would say, somebody invented a new kind of wire in Stockholm. Meanwhile, in Warrington, and then he'd appear in Warrington wearing the same clothes, saying that somebody had invented something that would, you know, then go on to become part of a great technological innovation. He was all about how technology and breakthroughs don't take place in one place, they are spread around the world. And he's redone it for the radio, and it's actually better and, in fact, cheaper to make. And he now sounds like Peter Sallis in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Ooh. As well. So he will say, I'm going to tell you how we're going to get from yarn making in, 15th century Netherlands to the Tesla car with Elon Musk via the Hundred Years' War and the invention of the golf club. And he does it, and he hopscotches in 15 minutes. They're all available on a podcast from BBC Radio 4. They're absolutely fantastic. And if you've got 15 minutes to spare, they are the way to use it.
This is James Burke, who used to present Tomorrow's World.
That's right? He, yes.
You probably know this, being you, But Tomorrow's World was the first programme on British television in which Kraftwerk appeared.
This is true.
Get out of town.
This is true.
1976.
Playing their electronic drums with knitting needles.
I knew you'd know that, but I also know that you can't pronounce the word Jimmy Iovine correctly.
Well, as a big fan of Jimmy Iovine, I take exception to that. I think that's the end of our show. Thank you for listening, everyone. Thank you to Dylan Jones and Sophie Harris for joining us. Are we all going to go home and listen to the Buzzcocks?
We are indeed. Right now.
Absolutely.
Right now, yeah.
And even the post-reunion albums are worth listening to as well. Patreon backers, look out for the extra bit arriving soon where we're going to be discussing the best and worst people that our guests have interviewed. Thank you to Sean for being my wing person again. And thank you to producer Alex Rees. Thanks for listening. We'll see you all next time.